Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Motherkind podcast with me, your host, Zoe Blasky, where each week I chat about all things motherhood and well-being. My mission with this podcast is to help you reconnect to you, to feel happier, more joyful, calmer, and that little bit kinder to yourself, because I think life as a mum in this hectic modern world is hard enough as it is. I believe becoming the happiest, most alive version of ourselves is the most important and inspiring thing we can do for our children. This episode is kindly sponsored by Zendium toothpaste, which is different because it actually strengthens your mouth's natural defenses. I've been using it for a few months now, and I can massively tell the difference. My mouth actually feels healthier. What I also love about Zendium is their commitment to the planet. They recently removed the cardboard box from all their toothpastes, saving hundreds of millions of tons of cardboard every year. Isn't that an example of one of those super simple but massively impactful changes? I've often wondered why toothpaste comes not only in a tube, obviously, but also has that cardboard box around it. So it's such a brilliant change that they've made. And the Zendium tubes are also made from plant-based plastic and are fully recyclable. So when you give Zendium a try, not only are you being kinder to your mouth, but also the planet. I would love you to try it out. I've got all my friends and family using it now too. They are all loving it too. So if you go to zendium.co.uk, pop Motherkind in at the checkout and you will get 20% off. That's zendium.co.uk, pop Motherkind in at the checkout for 20% off. Hi everyone, welcome to this episode of the Motherkind podcast. I hope you're really well. This episode is going out on Christmas Eve, so I hope you are having a beautiful day of calm and fun and connection, and that you are all ready for the big day tomorrow. If you're a regular listener to the podcast, then you may know that through the Christmas period, I re-release the most popular episodes from the season before. So today's episode is with Joanna Fortune. Joanna is a clinical psychotherapist and attachment specialist. She's been working with children and families for over 20 years and has pioneered the 15-minute parenting concept. Now, when I first put this episode out a couple of months ago, I was inundated with emails and messages from you all telling me how refreshing and accessible and still quite profound you had found Joanna's message. And I've been reflecting on why that is. And I think, as you'll know, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we often talk about how our connection with our children, our relationship with our children, is their blueprint for all their relationships going forward in their lives. And I think that can put so much pressure on us as parents, can't it? And I work and my husband works. And I think sometimes it can feel like we need to spend more and more and more time with our children. And I think the reason this episode resonated so strongly is because Joanna's message is clear. It's not necessarily about the number of hours that you're spending with your children, but the quality that you spend with them, how present you're able to be in just 15 minutes a day, how deep you can get that connection in just 15 minutes a day. Can you fully connect with your children on the deepest level possible in just 15 minutes a day? And I think that's why this episode really did resonate, because it's reassuring and yet incredibly practical. So Joanna and I talk about how important it is that we are able to show up in that way, present, connected, grounded. And I think that's such a red thread that runs through all these conversations we have on the podcast, is that parenting starts with us. And Joanna says, parenting starts with introspection. We also talk about intergenerational parenting, which, as you know, is one of my absolute passions. And Joanna shares that, you know, we think we're showing up present in the moment, but actually we are carrying with us three generations before us of their reactions and the blueprinting that we have on us. So one way we get to be fully present in that pure connection is unpacking some of that stuff first. We also talk about the inner critic and how our own inner critic can get passed on to our children, which is just fascinating. And at the end, we talk about play and how we can use 15 minutes of play a day to get this deep, profound, intimate connection that we want with our children. So I hope you really enjoy it. Even if you've listened to it before, I hope you choose to listen again, because what I hear from you is that when you listen to these episodes again, you hear something different each time. So I'd love you to tell me what you heard differently this time, or maybe if this is the first time listening to this episode, what you got out of it. And as ever, if you did enjoy it, please do consider leaving me a review on iTunes or sharing it with another parent who you think might benefit from it. Here it is. Joanna, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to chat this morning.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. I've been looking forward to talking with you.
Oh, well, I read the book, which is 15, remind me of the title, it's totally escaped me. Sorry, I haven't got it in front of me.
No, it's 15 Minute Parenting. And I think the one you read was the 0 to 7 years, the first book in the series. So there are three books. So 15 Minute Parenting, 0 to 7 years. And that's looking at those all important early childhood years. Then the green cover is the 8 to 12 years, middle childhood. I felt really strongly about having a book dedicated to middle childhood because, you know, psychological and parenting fields, it's often the age group that is most under discussed. You know, we talk about the early years, then the teenage years, and we tend to catapult forward and short circuit that journey. And I think the middle childhood years are really important. So I was delighted to spotlight that. And coming actually on October 23rd is the teenage years book that'll have a red cover. So the three books will be fully out there by October 23rd. But at the moment, 0 to 7 and 8 to 12 are.
Brilliant. Well, we're going to get into this 15-minute concept. I love it. You know, as a kind of busy working mum, I love it. But yeah. I wanted to start off, you know, so much of what we discuss on this podcast. In fact, if one thing aligns all our conversations, it's that we can only give what we've got, you know, as parents and mothers.
Absolutely.
We can only be as good a parent as we are. Parenting ourselves is something that we talk about a lot. So I thought it might be really interesting to start there. And you say in the first kind of couple of chapters of the book that parenting starts with introspection, and there is no better way than realizing you have unresolved issues from your own childhood than to become a parent. And this was so true for me, because when I became a parent, I had been in recovery from loads of dysfunctional behaviors for 10 years when I became a parent. And it still absolutely floored me, and so much old trauma and memories and pain came up. It always gives me so much comfort. I mean, I think that's honestly why I started the podcast, because I felt like no one was really talking about that. So why did you put that right at the start of the book?
Really, for all of the reasons you've just articulated perfectly there, that, you know, I do firmly believe that there is no better way to discover your own unresolved stuff than to become a parent, because that transition from being the child of a parent to being the parent of a child is psychologically huge. Like, it is huge transition. And I think so many of us get used to, in terms of, you know, functioning in everyday life, that there are some of the big stuff we might go, yeah, I'm aware this happened and that happened, and I've had those experiences and I've looked at those. But beneath those, there could be a whole layer of other stuff, like a breadcrumb trail is how I'd look at it. And we're great as human beings at putting all those things into boxes and just hammering shut the lids, pushing them down and go, do you know what? Not right now. I'll deal with that another day. And then all of a sudden, you have this life-changing event. You become a parent, and making a baby, that baby also makes you a parent. So there's a transaction there. It brings up all of that stuff. And you know what happens is all those lids of those boxes fly open, usually at the most inopportune moment. You know, you've got a newborn, you don't have the time or resources to be dealing with your own emotional stuff. Mm-hmm. And it can leave you feeling quite flooded and overwhelmed. So for me, I actually always come back to, I think children are very important. I think they should always be really important in our families if we choose to have them. But I do not advocate that children should be the most important thing in a home or relationship, because I actually think that your own well-being, taking care of yourself, nurturing and investing your intimate partner relationship, sustaining those are a gift to your children. as best we can do that. So investing in yourself and saying, look, I need to mind myself, is a great way of modeling self-care for our children as well. But it's also saying, I can only be what you need me to be if I take care of myself too. So it is a balancing act. You know, it really is, because you started by saying, you know, we're all so busy, and that's so true. You know, we're running on empty, especially at the times we're living in. And it can be really difficult to say, you know, when's the last time I just sat and had a hot cup of tea or coffee? Or when's the last time I did that class that I used to love going to? Or I met up with my friends just for a night out or an afternoon out, whatever it might be, a brunch. When is the last time I did something that was truly authentically for me and my desire and my passion? And frequently in my work, when I ask that question, there's this dramatic pause. So people are going, gosh, you know, when was the last time I really did something that was just for me? And that's something I feel really strongly about. I think we do need to take care of ourselves, our non-parent selves, so that we can be our best parent selves.
What's so interesting, though, is I think they're two quite separate things, as I see it. It'd be good to unpack this with you.
Yeah.
Introspection and really having the courage to unpack some of our own childhood stuff is really different in my experience than the self-care things you were just talking about. Because the self-care things, they feel nice, right? Like when I say, actually, I'm going to go to that yoga class, or I'm going to, you know, that's nurturing myself. But unpacking, I would love you to talk through the parental self-audit, you know, asking ourselves those really hard questions, like, actually, was I seen and heard as a child?
Yeah.
And am I able to see and hear my child? I don't think that's fun, personally.
No. You're right.
I think it's important to pull this out, because I get really passionate and frustrated, actually, that the two often get confused out there in the rhetoric. And I think your book brilliantly kind of separates.
Absolutely. You're so right. It's a little bit like how we talk about, you know, mental health and mental well-being as well. All of those self-care things are so important to put yourself front and center at least once in a while. But in order to draw benefit from those, you have to be in a place where you can say, actually, I do feel the benefit. I do feel better having done that. And that's why the parental self-audit is a separate part in this book, because that is the introspection piece. To parent outwards, you have to go inwards first. And I have included in here some, as you've just said, you know, some really hard questions. And you may not have the answers to all of them. And sometimes what it brings up for you is, actually, you know, I have to look at that. I have to go somewhere and look at fixing this stuff. So for me, the parental self-audit isn't a one-off thing. It's something that you can revisit and should revisit and return to. But you basically start by asking yourself some questions. But what's really important, you know, Zoe, as you were saying, is it's not just about asking yourself questions, it's answering those questions, you know, because you have to answer them as fully and as honestly as you can. And then you just note, even to yourself, if something that you feel requires further reflection or support comes up within that. But you've named a couple of the questions, but there are things like, you know, what was growing up like for you? In what ways was your relationship with your mother similar to or different from your relationship with your father? How were you disciplined as a child? How did it make you feel at the time? How do you feel about it now? Who played with you as a child? Did you lose someone important? How were successes celebrated? How were disappointments managed? There's questions like that all the way through, and you have to bring up in your mind the answers to those. And some of those are going to be really warm and reassuring and remind you, gosh, yeah, I really liked that. I can do that with my child. And some of it isn't going to feel like that. It's going to be, gee, that wasn't easy for me. And even recalling it, I'm reminded it's not easy. What we're looking for, though, when we do this is a process called reflective functioning, whereby I can recall things that happened to me in the past or that I experienced in the past. But I'm recalling them from a position now of fresh thinking and new perspective, that I can say, yeah, you know, this was really bad. I really struggled with it. I felt really upset. And I remember this is what I did to try and fix it or make it better, or this is how it worked out. But in recalling it, I don't re-experience it in the now. If when we recall something from the past and it brings up really strong emotions, it's like, oh my goodness, it just happened. It feels very raw, very active and very current. Then that's something that is as yet unprocessed for you. And you owe it to yourself to give yourself attention and time to look at that with a suitably qualified professional. It would be my recommendation that you can say, look, this has come up for me. I realize it's very active. It hasn't resolved. And it's something that I want to look at now, because it's those echoes from our past that will play out now with our children.
That is so important. And I think just in the narrative around parenting, I don't know if you must feel this way, which is why you've done the books, you know, it's just so often not talked about.
Not at all.
I feel like actually, this is why Gabor Mate, who I just adore his work, and I know you do too, you know, says the primary act of parenting is self-parenting. Because actually, as you say, until I become conscious and aware of some of the things that happened to me and how that's impacted how I'm likely to parent, it would be good to get your view. You know, what I see is either a direct repetition of that or a penduluming into the total opposite, which is still a reaction against. So how do we get to, you know, once we've become aware, perhaps it's like an experience from my own childhood was actually, I felt like there wasn't any space for my feelings. Mm-hmm. I notice, I think I probably go too far on validating Jessie's feelings, and I don't do well enough on the boundaries, helping her.
That's so interesting. And I totally get that, that, you know, one way or another, aren't we guided by our past? Because even when you say, look, this didn't happen for me, so I'm going to make sure it happens for my child. The fact that it didn't happen for you is still what's guiding and influencing your actions.
Exactly. How do we get to the, is it only once we've really healed, I use healed, I think you use the word processed, that we then are able to kind of clean slate parent?
Yeah, and I don't even know if we can ever clean slate parent. I'm one of five siblings, okay? So if you were to take me and all of my siblings and line us up and ask us the same set of questions about our parents and growing up, we would give you five different sets of answers. Because even though we had the same parents who, objectively speaking, parented in the same way with the same thought process or parenting philosophy for all of us, how we each experienced that is different, because we're all different.
Yeah.
So for me, the word process comes up because it's actually through processing there's healing. But I think it's about looking at, yes, all of these things happened and some of it was good and some of it was really not. But I have learned from all of that and I'm moving forward in an informed way. So it's like we take those breadcrumb trail, that memory that's buried deep down, and it's only by interweaving it with narrative that it enters our conscious awareness. So it's learning to speak those experiences. And sometimes we can do that through reflective exercises, such as a parental self-audit. And sometimes we need somebody neutral in our lives who can bear witness to that and reflect our own words back to us, such as a psychotherapist, a psychologist, or somebody in that field. And I think there's strength to be gleaned from saying, yeah, you know, this is bigger than me. I need some help with that. In the same way, if you had a recurring injury in your physical body, you would go to somebody about that. You wouldn't say, I'm just going to shake that off. You'd go to a physiotherapist or somebody who could help you with that recurring injury. It's the same kind of thing. And I think for me, it comes up, clinically speaking, when a child is presented to me as, my child is having struggles, my child needs some help. Often, you know, and you quoted, you know, Gabor Mate there, but also Carl Jung said something that came to my mind when you were talking there. He said, you know, if there's anything that we wish to change in the child, we should first examine it and see whether it is not something that we could better be changed in ourselves. And it's not always, I do want to put that out there, every struggle our children have isn't always something that's within us. But there's something very empowering rather than guilty. We shouldn't feel badly about this, because if it's something that's an echo of us, look at the amazing opportunity we have to change that. To look at, actually, you know, yes, this makes sense to me. And by it making sense to me now, I can make sense of it with and for you, my child. And your child grows up without that staying with them. I often think it comes up around conflict and discipline issues. You mentioned boundaries, so that's really interesting to me, because boundaries and limit setting are the route to safety for children and secure attachment. They're never going to thank you for it, by the way. Thank you for those boundaries and limits, you know, said no child ever. But they do thank you in how they live safely and securely within those boundaries. So I think by the time we snap or lose it or get irritated or maybe more than irritated, get enraged or angry with our children, by the time that happens, it's not because of what our child did or said. It is because of what got activated in us when they did or said it. And that goes back to us. So you have to start with yourself and really looking at, how did I experience being the child of my parents? What did that mean to me at the time? And now with my adult retrospection, how can I better make sense of that now? Or maybe there's parts of it that still don't make sense, but I'm aware that it's playing out like an internal soundtrack in my life. But you know, it's a bit like having a bruise and you know it hurts, but you keep touching it to make sure it still hurts.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm not the only one who does that. Ouch, yeah, still sore, still sore. And I think it's that compulsion to repeat. You know, in psychoanalytic literature, that it's talked about, you know, when there's something there and it's still there, we have a compulsion to repeat it in a bid to make sense of it. So the parental self-audit is there to really say, look, we matter. We're important. And we're extremely important. We're the most important people in our children's lives. We owe it to ourselves and our children to do right by ourselves and to give ourselves this time to really look at, who am I as a parent? And no matter how many books you read and say, okay, that's the kind of parent I choose to be, when your own attachment system is activated, when you're in an emotional interaction with your child, which, let's face it, is multiple times a day, every day, it's not what you read in a book that you default to, it's what you lived. And so we have to shine a light on what we lived.
Yeah, you're so right. And, you know, I often reflect on this because I've done, you know, a fair amount of work. Like, you know, I've been in psychotherapy 10 years now. You know, I've done 12 steps multiple times. You know, I've done all the retreats, I've done all the healings. And what I notice is that when I'm not activated, I'm pretty good at this stuff. I can contain myself. But the moment I go into stress, you know, and that cortisol gets triggered in me, I go right back to my programming, which is putting a need to be loved above all else. You know, I'm sure your attachment theory is pretty
absolutely important. And that makes such sense, doesn't it? We often hear when somebody meets somebody new and they're excited about the relationship and they say, you know, I really love this person. They get me. They really get me. And I think that's what we all want, is to get gotten, for somebody to understand us and not just understand us, you know, on a, oh yes, I understand what you're saying right now, but to understand us from the inside out, to know how we tick, how we work, how our rhythms move and what affects us and doesn't. And when you're with somebody who truly gets you and you get that feeling, that's something really powerful. And in attachment work, for me, that goes back to those early couple of months when a baby, it's often called the fourth trimester, also the codependent stage of development. Yeah. But in those first 3-4 months, a baby doesn't yet know that they're a separate being to their mother. Okay. You know, that nook of the arm time when you're holding your baby, and for the purpose of what I'm saying now, you're looking at your baby with love. Okay. Your baby doesn't see you, but they see themselves reflected through you. So from the baby's point of view, it's not, I love you. It's, I'm lovable. I'm deserving of love. And they see themselves reflected through you. So after they begin to go, would you look at that? You know, the world is bigger than you and I. In fact, there is a you and I, and now there are others. This is crazy. I have to get my head around that. And they're looking for people that make them feel the way that felt. So they are more responsive to others in their attachment network who love them, truly love them, because it reinforces that sense that I'm lovable. It's why, you know, if you take your buggy out and a stranger or a neighbor looks in and, you know, oh, cute baby, your baby doesn't light up for them the way they do for a grandparent or another parent who truly loves them. So it is that sense of, I am making sense of my sense of self. The scaffolding for that is already laid down in those first few months of life.
It's so fascinating, isn't it? So the good thing I think about attachment, you know, having looked a lot at my own attachment, is that it can be healed, can't it?
Absolutely. Repair. Yeah. The repair of ruptured attachment.
I know with my first, you know, it's so fascinating. You know, I felt so strongly about wanting to have sleeping on me and co-sleep. Mm-hmm. And actually, it didn't quite go. It did with my second, interestingly. But with Jessie, you know, I definitely let her cry in her cot on her own more than I should have. You know, it's really interesting to me how I had the knowledge, as you say, but I think there was still parts of me that couldn't quite handle that intimacy and that dependency.
Oh, and the constancy of demand. And yeah. Don't forget that Jessie made you a parent. Yeah. Jessie made you a mum, not your second child. You were already a mum then. So that's a very different transaction as well. It's really powerful between your first child for that reason.
So I'm wondering, you know, if people are listening, perhaps like I would be, you know, if I was listening to this conversation and, you know, I heard you say those first 2 months, you know, really do create the foundation of worth and how someone sees themselves. Can you talk to the repair?
Absolutely. And look, I don't know, am I an eternal optimist? And if I am, so be it. But I genuinely, and I've done attachment specialized work. You know, my clinical work with psychotherapy is attachment repair, trauma recovery work, and working with the parent-child relationship or the caregiver-child relationship. So I have seen people come in the heights of rupture. And over, you know, I'm not going to say it's a quick fix. It's a journey. It's work. Like you've said, you've done 10 years yourself working on all of this, is that recovery and repair is always possible. It's not easy because you have to look at things that are really difficult to look at. Mm-hmm. You have to go to places that, you know, really you've maybe spent a lot of your life actively avoiding those dark corners of yourself. But be aware that somebody who is skilled in attachment repair work and trauma recovery work isn't going to go, well, there it is, right there. I found it for you. Now deal with it. It's very slow, steady, respectful work because emotional flooding should always be considered. So it's going to be somebody who minds you as you mind yourself through that journey. And that's really important. But it is always possible. And there are some wonderful play-based, and I really, as you know from reading the book, I see play and playfulness as more than a box of toys in the corner of a room. Play is a state of mind. It's a way of being. And playful connection is very healing. So I'm really interested in the kinds of attachment-focused therapies that use playfulness as a language. And that could be TheraPlay is one very good example of dyadic, that is, you know, parent and child or caregiver-child therapy, where you are not the client or the child is not the client in focus, but the relationship between you is what is in focus. So it's all done through very selected play. It's play with purpose. It's not just blowing bubbles for bubbles' sake. It's knowing what you're doing, when and why. And there's another one called dyadic developmental psychotherapy, or DDP is its acronym for short. And it's more talk-based, but it's very playful as well in that narrative. There's a reason that works, because actually it's speaking to a part of our brain that is accessible when we are in a state of rupture. And what I mean by that, if you think of when you lose it, you know, like when you just snap and lose it, and I'm saying when, because we all do this, okay? We have to start from a place of honesty of saying, yes, we all lose it sometimes. But when you do, you often hear people use that phrase, I flipped my lid. And when you flip your lid, what has actually happened is your lid is your neocortex. It's that logical, reasoning, reflective, good choice-making part of your brain. And when you flip your lid, that part of your brain goes offline. You don't have access to it. And when somebody tries to talk to you, I mean, in the history of being stressed, have the words calm down ever actually calmed anyone down? I mean, no. Never. In fact, it exacerbates, because the part of your brain that could hear, receive, and process those words is offline. You're actually down in the limbic amygdala emotional center of your brain. And that part of your brain is on fire when you're stressed and activated. It's firing those fight, flight, freeze cues at you. And whatever way you're wired to either fight, you know, get into conflict and get combative and fight your corner, or flight, run away from that, shut down, get quiet, hide, retreat, or freeze, do nothing, say nothing, get passive, get really quiet. Whatever way you're oriented, that's from your story of growing up. That's your attachment story. There isn't a better or worse one. That's our brain's way of keeping us safe when we're in a state of stress, attack, anxiety, whatever it might be. We're under threat. Keep yourself as safe as possible. I'm cueing you to fight this. Flee it or freeze. And then if you're in that part of your brain for a prolonged period of time, the lower realms of your brain are also going to get affected. So, you know, that area of the brain to do with motor regulation. So am I hungry, full, hot, cold, tired, energetic, not being able to read your physical body cues, coordination, feeling very clumsy, walking into things, dropping things. And you know those times when you walk into, again, I'm saying when, because I'm assuming we all do this and not just me, you walk into your kitchen and you kind of stand there for a moment and go, what did I come in here for?
Yeah,
multiple times. What am I doing? So that's a sign that, you know, we're a little offline. And when we have a good, healthy system of knowing how to self-repair, self-recover and get back online, I might know I'm tired. I should actually have a cup of tea and a biscuit, or I should get outside and get some fresh air for a couple of minutes. When I get into I should, I know that I have a way of getting myself back online. If I don't have those inner resources, then I'm going to sink even further. And in extreme trauma, extreme stress, I might go the whole way down into my brainstem where, you know what, I'm just trying to stay alive. Heart rate, blood pressure, breathing. But if I'm down in those lower areas of my brain, and somebody comes to me and says, let's talk about what just happened there. And think of it as a parent with your child. Your child has lost it. You know, they've had a complete meltdown, which is different to a tantrum, but they've had a complete meltdown. And we come in and go, I'm going to talk at you now about what happened. And I'm going to give you verbal direction as to what you're to do going forward. That is like the radiator on and the window open. That can't possibly land. Not for our children and not for us when we're in that state. Words alone won't do it. And that's why I think attachment-focused work is more than words. It's doing communication, not just speaking it. And for me, that's the essence of using play as a language.
Yeah, so it's so interesting because what I was thinking there, you know, is it's so easy to become a child again.
Yes.
With our children, you know, I know that I can quite clearly see actually I've lost, as you say, my prefrontal cortex. You know, my adult self is no longer functioning here. And I am, you know, because children don't have that till the age of 7, my understanding totally.
That's right. Yes.
So the both of us are kind of in our, you know, in our limbic, in our activity. So when someone finds themselves in that space, we all know it, where we might be shaming our children, you know, you just get it right. What's wrong with you? They're doing it, you know, comparing to other children or screaming at our children or maybe wanting to walk away from them. If you don't come, I'm just going to leave you in the supermarket.
Yeah.
How does someone in that moment, you know, you said words aren't going to work. So how does the parent get themselves back into the adult to then help the child?
Oh, there's so much there. Because I think, you know, when we do go to that shaming language where we're seeking to shame somebody else, it's actually a projection of our own shame base, because shame is so difficult to contain and hold on to. And one of the most effective ways, damaging, but effective ways to get rid of that icky, uncomfortable feeling within ourselves is to evacuate it and project it onto somebody else. So often when we end up putting somebody else into shame, when we've said something shaming, that's the moment to kind of hit your internal pause button and go, oh, what of my own stuff have I just put out there in this moment?
It's so, so, so important because I hang around a lot. You know, I have two kids, you know, I'm in play groups, I'm in the supermarkets, I'm at school drop-offs. And I think this kind of casual shaming is an epidemic. I hear it constantly. I do it myself, you know, I'm so far from perfect. I hear it all the time. What's wrong with you? Why can't you just? So I think this idea that when we hear those shaming words, you know, maybe useful actually for you to give a few more examples of what shaming is so that people could recognize it in how they interact with their children, that that is a real sign. You know, we started this conversation by talking about introspection. That is a real sign for introspection.
Oh, isn't it just? And you know, actually, Zoe, I did a TEDx talk back in 2017, a few weeks after I'd given birth. So that was a story in itself. But I did it on shame, actually. Shame and social media, particularly, because I think, you know, social media is a shame playground. You know, as soon as you screen grab a message and send it to someone and say, would you look at this? You know, we're engaged in a shame narrative. So I think when we look at this, you have to, first of all, distinguish in your mind what's guilt and what's shame. Guilt is about behavior. Shame is about the person. And if what you do or say has made the person feel badly, that's about shame. If it was focused on what you did and said about your behavior, and there's some guilt, there is pro-social benefit to some degree of guilt because it enables us to change our behavior. It enables us to go, gosh, that wasn't my finest moment. And I'm sorry, I regret that. And I can make repair with you. And you said something so interesting when you said, you know, you can become a child yourself in relation to your own child in certain interactions. And when that happens, it's a bit like having a hot potato, and that's what the shame is. And you just toss it back and forth.
Yeah.
You're a child, and then the child does something that triggers in you, oh my goodness, I'm a bad parent. And because now I'm in my shame place of being a bad parent, I'm going to act out of being a bad parent and do all the bad parent things just so I can feel even more shamed. It's that reinforcement that without actually being able to say, it's toxic. Shame is toxic. You cannot contain it. It will find its way out. It'll play out in some way in our lives. And when we think about becoming a child in relation to our child, it's worth going back into remembering within each of us, there is a parent, adult, and child voice, let's say. And my parent voice can have two tones. It can be that nagging parent voice. I'm going to you, let me tell you what to do. And here's all the things you're doing wrong. Or it could be a nurturing parent voice. Oh, you poor thing. Sit down there now till I mind you and take care of you. My adult voice is where I'd like to think I spend most of my time being reasonable and rational and reflective. And my child voice or children voices within me is either that whingy, whiny, well, why does it always happen to me? I've got so much work on. I'm doing more than everyone else voice versus the woohoo, every day's a Friday in my world, carefree child voice. We all have those. And what they look and sound like within us is a direct result of what was put into us by our own parents.
Yes.
From their parent, adult.
I'm so fascinated by this. I'm so fascinated because we often talk about inner critic.
Oh, yeah.
It's an inherited critic, right?
And it's inherited. I mean, look, it sounds like, you know, listen, there's always someone else to blame. But what I'm really saying is that by the time you open your mouth, it is the result of three generations that has shaped what you're going to do or say in this moment. That's your parents, what they put into you, and what was put into each of them by their respective parents.
Yeah.
So to think that in those heightened moments that we have control over what's going to come out, we often do not. But by being curious, and I talk in the book about, you know, mentalizing as well. And mentalizing is really about trying to understand misunderstanding, trying to make sense of what doesn't make sense. And when we do that, we are staying out of a place of knowing and we are assuming a position of seeking to understand. And that's where I talk about wondering and being curious. Because if you come at this from a place of, I have a story I'm telling myself right now, this is how I'm making sense of what's just gone on, but I might be wrong. And if I can stay in a place of curiosity and say, I'm not quite sure I get what happened. This is what I'm telling myself. Does that make sense to you? And the other person can then say, yes, you're right. I am blaming you and it was all your fault. Or they can say, no, gosh, it wasn't about you at all. Here's where I was coming from with that. And all of a sudden, you've got something that fills in those dots, those spaces that joins it up. And that's about interweaving with narrative. But when we can't do that, we tend to get into this standoff of it's your fault. It's not mine. Maybe it's mine. I don't want it to be mine. I'm going to make it yours. And we get into that shaming interaction and that shaming narrative.
This is so important. And something I kind of liked on the podcast is take your incredible depth and expertise and try and make it really real for people. And I think this is how my understanding, tell me if I'm wrong,
oh sure,
of how this works generationally. So if you had a mother who was criticized by her mother, and therefore her inner voice might be critical to herself, she's mm-hmm. likely, not necessarily I guess, but likely to criticize her child in moments that she feels activated. So that child then develops a critical inner voice. So when they become a parent, they are likely to criticize. And this is why we talk about, you know, and it's so helpful, I think, to break it down like that, is the parenting. And you said it, you know, you think you're parenting afresh, but really it's three generations back.
Absolutely.
And I just think this is so profound. Like I could talk all day long about this, because I think it's absolutely the missing piece of modern parenting. Like we just don't seen to talk about it. And I love how you say in the book, you know, please don't spend £1,000 on a bugaboo. Go and figure, unpack some of this stuff out if you can. And that is my experience. It's like, if you want your children, everyone says, don't they? I just want my children to be happy. And yet, the real way, I think, and my passion and what I'm trying to do with Motherkind is actually say, if you really want that, go and unpack some of your own stuff, because that will become, as you're so helpfully describing for everyone, that will become, to some degree, you say history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes, their experience.
Absolutely. And I think as well, you know, if you are listening and thinking back, you know, gosh, that does describe a very difficult relationship I had with my own parent. Am I doomed to repeat that? You're not, because another part of the parental self-audit is to look at, did you have important adults in your life outside of your immediate family? And who were they? And in what ways were they important? Because actually, all it takes is that you come into contact, ideally early, but you know, I'm an optimist, as I said, it's never too late. So I think if you come into contact with a child-minded adult, a child-minded caregiver, that could be a teacher, a neighbor, a relative, a social worker, that could have been anybody in your life, that might be enough. That might be enough to have put into you, there is another way of doing this. And well, I could follow the other way.
Change that inner narrative.
Exactly. It can break that cycle and just put you onto a different trajectory. And that's what we're really talking about here. You also mentioned, though, Zoe, something about, you know, we all make these mistakes and we're not perfect. And I think that's great. You know, I just want to put out there that perfect is not good enough. And it's something that the child psychotherapist Donald Winnicott would have written about over the years, is that perfection is not good enough. Good enough is good enough. Because actually, if we strive for perfection, we are not giving ourselves permission to make mistakes. And if we don't make mistakes, we are foreclosing opportunities to learn. And if we don't learn, then nothing changes. Actually, I think when we do have those less than glorious moments with our children and we yell, I mean, I literally write books on this and do this for a living, but I'm not my child's professional. I'm my child's parent. So when I parent her, all of my own experiences and activations, of course, are in play. So what I would be very clear about is that if I get it wrong, and when I get it wrong, that I come back and say, I'm sorry, I did that. I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have yelled. I got angry, but really it was because I was scared that you would run out on the road. So I yelled at you in my very cross voice and you got a fright, but I was scared and I'm sorry I did it like that. You can come back and make sense of what didn't make sense. If you think about when your child is struggling to do something, you know, like take the lid off a Lego box, because that's hard. And they try and they try and they fail and they fail and they get so frustrated that they throw the box across the room in a temper. If we come in and we say, don't throw your toys because you threw your Legos, it's going away now, you've no Legos for the day. They've learned nothing. And now they were already upset. And now you've punished the upset. So they're just thinking you're mean. They don't link that to what they did. But if you can come in and say, oh, you tried and tried to get the lid off the box and it wouldn't work. You got so mad that you threw your box across the room. Then you retrieve the box and you subtly loosen the lid and say, now let's try it together. One, two, three, the lid comes off. You say, you did it. So you have made sense of what happened. Your overt behavior, throwing of the box, was underpinned by your emotional state of frustration, which was underpinned by the physical state of not being strong enough to get the lid off the box. You are, through repeated experience of that, teaching your child that I do and say things because of how I think and feel. That can take people their whole lives to work out.
Yes, I was just thinking that. I was like, you know, this is what I do with Jesse. And I have to say, I do this. I'm proud of how well I do this, given that I had zero modeling around this stuff. But it's taken me still today, I can grapple with what is my feeling under my behavior, because you know, I had amazing parents. They loved us so much, but they just didn't have the gift of, you know, they'd never had therapy. They had their own unresolved traumas. So there was never looked past the behavior.
We have to do that. And especially remember, I know we think that our 18-month-old, two-year-olds are evil geniuses and they know exactly what they're doing. But, you know, the true thing is that they don't have the cognition to do that at that age. So consistently anyway, cause and effect does not develop until 4 years old. So they throw the box, they feel upset. They're not linking those two. They need us to link that in a kind way. Now, you might be returning the box and say, but remember, we don't throw toys, okay? So you're still going to hold the boundary. I do think we lost the run of ourselves in the world of parenting over the last kind of 20 years or so in saying children must have choices. Of course, they must have choices. Absolutely, they should and must have choices. But those choices should be within parental boundaries. It's not about saying to a child, what do you want to do? It's about saying, do you want to go to the park or to the beach? I'm happy with either of those, but lucky you, you get to choose. So if I say, where do you want to go? And they want to go to the zoo and the zoo isn't on the agenda today. Now we're actually fighting. Or if I say, what do you want to drink with your dinner? And they say, cola. And really, I meant milk or water. I should have said milk or water. Do you want milk or water? Oh, you made a choice. Great. But it was within my parental scaffolding. So we have to think of boundaries as a measure that creates safety and reassurance. And that creates security. And that's about healthy attachment.
Because if a child has too much power, quote unquote, that feels really
terrifying.
Terrifying, because it's like, if you're not in charge.
Oh, yes. It's completely overwhelming.
Exactly. I have been guilty of that. Not a lot, but I've definitely, in moments of my 4.5 years with Jessie, given her too much power.
But you know, it's about catching yourself, Zoe, as well, and saying, yeah, silly me, I meant to say milk or water. I wasn't clear about that. What I meant to say was, do you want milk or water? You can correct that in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's so true what you say about perfectionism, because there's this kind of dichotomy, isn't there? Is that this conversation, and I think we know so much more than ever before about the profound impact that parenting can have. And yet it's kind of holding the duality of, yes, I know this role is so important and I have to look at my stuff, and if I'm shaming, or, you know, that could have lasting impact. Yet I also have to know that I'm going to do this really imperfectly.
Yep.
And to some extent, I'm going to mess this up. But it's so fascinating, because before we had Jessie, we were in couples therapy, because I was petrified of becoming a mum, because I kept saying, I've got so much unresolved trauma and I can kind of see it on the edges. You know, I'm not processed, I'm not healed in these areas. And, you know, and the therapist was very wise. And she said, you know, if you wait for you to do this perfectly, you will wait forever.
100%.
And I think perfection is, I'm starting to see, is another trauma response for me.
Oh, it is. It's about control. Yeah.
There's this amazing duality to hold, isn't there, of knowing the importance of the parental role, as we've talked about, and the lasting impact, and yet knowing that simultaneously I am going to mess it up.
But isn't that the essence of knowing you're an adult? You know, I always think that when you can look back on your own parents and how you experience them, and you can acknowledge and accept their limitations and love them anyway, congratulations, you're an adult.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's an ongoing challenge for me. You know, I have the types of conversations that you and I are having every day, basically. And it's like, wow, it's so interesting to me to hold myself in imperfect compassion for this stuff. And the other thing I think is so important is an acceptance that, yes, my girls, to some extent, are going to grow up with trauma with a lower T. You know, they're going to grow up with pain. They're going to grow up, because that is part of life. But I think the difference than when I was growing up is my husband and I talk really openly about therapy at dinner.
Absolutely. And that's so healthy. You know,
I'll talk openly about going to recovery meetings. I'll talk openly about when things are hard, this is what we can do. There was none of that conversation. So I think that's kind of my philosophy, is like, actually, I'll do my best. I'll mess up, but they will know where to go and repair some of this stuff outside of our relationship if they need to.
Absolutely. And I think it's also why, you know, the book is, of course, about play and using play, because in my work with families, one of the most common things that I heard over, you know, my 20 plus years in this work is, by the time I've done this and this and this, and I'm so busy and I have so many demands, by the time I've done everything, I'm lucky if I have 15 minutes with my child every day. What can I do in 15 minutes? Yeah. And I started, you know, a concept called fridge notes, with the idea that you'd print things and stick them to your fridge of, I'll give you things you can do in 15 minutes. If you've got 15 minutes, let's make that work for you. Because actually, I would rather you do just 15 minutes, but do it every single day, then do an hour and a half on a Monday and then nothing till Friday. Because if you do little but often, you are predictable for your child. And if you are predictable, you are safe. And if you are safe, our connection is secure. And that's about attachment. That's about saying, I'm here. But also, I've spoken to so many parents who will say, I'm not really good at the play thing. Like, I'm just not really good at it. And sometimes that goes back to, and that's part of your audit, parental self-audit, is, you know, who played with you as a child? And what was that like for you? What was the type of play that brought you joy? Or what kind of play did you find very difficult? Or it's why I go into those stages of play. What did you miss, when and why? And also giving you that kind of roadmap of looking at, play isn't my natural inclination, but you know what? I firmly believe, I don't care what your background is, we all have a playful capacity. We just have to access it and find a way of doing that. And that's what the types of play, breaking it down, the lists of activities and games, to try out what works for you, what brings you alive, what sparks your playfulness.
I love that. And I think, you know, you say in the book, children don't tend to say, I'm having a really hard time. I feel X, Y, and Z. They say, will you play with me?
Exactly. And in the play, it's happening. If you want to know, we're all just going back to school and everything. And we're guilty of, you know, as soon as you get back with your child, what was your day like? What did you do? What did you learn? Where did you go? What happened?
Yes, firing questions at them.
They don't want to talk to you at all. They're done talking. Their neocortex has been stretched in school all day. They're tired. They're down in another part of their brain, the motor arousal. You would be much better off, be you on a bike, walking, or in a car, playing a game like Jelly and Ice Cream, which is a co-regulation game, so that you say jelly, they say ice cream back, but they have to say it the same way that you do. So if you yell jelly, they yell ice cream. If you whisper jelly, they whisper ice cream. And you bring your voice up and down and do all kinds of croaks and melodic pieces with that. Then if you do that for 5 minutes, first of all, it's 5 minutes of your play done. By the time you get in home, you're both in the same wavelength. You've gotten them co-regulated. If they get into the car and they're hyper, start with your loud jelly. If they come into the car and they're really quiet and low, start with your whisper and bring it up. So think of yourself as the thermostat, not the thermometer. You are setting the temperature. You're not measuring it.
That's such a good one. I'm going to do that. That's in the book. You know, what's great about the book is that, you know, you talk about all the stuff that we've just been unpacking, of course, but also how to use play as a way to connect. And I love that. I love that jelly and ice cream one. What other are some of the ones that readers of the book have just said to you, they love it? There's always a few in books like yours I'm conscious of that just really stand out for people. What are those ones? And can you share those with the listeners?
Oh yeah, I think people have really responded well to the explanation of the three stages of play and breaking down how to do each of those. So if you've got stage one, sensory, messy embodiment play, and you're, even me saying that is breaking you out in a sweat going, oh God, the messy play, I really don't like that. Then I've got lots of ways of containing the mess and emphasizing that we have to teach our children that we can contain their outer mess so that their internal mess, their chaos, their emotional stuff, that we can manage that too. So I've got lots of ways of, people have really responded well to the sensory basins and to the body map of feelings, about developing that emotional fluency and parts language, teaching children that they are not the angry child in your family. They are a child who is feeling angry right now, but they're made up of lots of feelings. Where do their other feelings live in their body? What color are their feelings? What shape? And where do they hold them physically? So people have really responded well to that. And to the story stemming, the narrative piece of stage two play, of using small world, you know, like the little doll's house or the little Sylvanian families or the Playmobiles, whatever it is you use, the little people, using that as a way of deepening and understanding, how does your child experience social situations or things that might be causing them problems? Or what actually happened with the situation that you have your own idea of, but you don't know what happened from your child's point of view? Playing it out at a removed level allows them to depersonalize it and go deeper into it. And I've given a roadmap on how to do that. But I think as well, the standout has been, in the book, I talk about doing Dance Your Moodies Away.
Yeah.
I actually can remember because people have said it so much, page 188 of the book, Just Dance. It's when everything is just getting to that too much level. You know, that witching hour when you've done all the games, you've done the jigsaws, the playing, you've done it all, and still somehow there's 90 minutes left before bedtime. And everything is just getting irritable. That what I do is just put on a song, whatever is on your Spotify list or your iPod, whatever it is. It could be Disney, it could be the Rolling Stones. Just play that song. And for the duration of that song, nobody does anything but dance. Flail your arms, stamp your legs, move, sway, get silly for that 3.5 minutes, because rhythm and synchrony trigger the subsystems of the brain associated with emotional regulation. It takes us all out of those verbal fighting parts of our brains into the more movement and coordination part. And it helps to bring us back online. And it's fun. Sometimes you don't need any more science than it's fun. Yeah. So dance the moodies away has been something people have said to me over and over. Oh, we dance the moodies away every day now. So that's been a standout as well. But I think there are loads, because other parents would speak to the armchair play. You know, when your parental stamina is through the floor, I'll still get you playing and you don't have to leave your chair. I've had a lot of parents say, thank you for armchair play.
Well, it's such a good resource. Because I think, like you say, you know, what's great about it is that you give these really practical ways, but actually, because of what you do, you know, your experience in your, all your trainings and qualifications, they are so rooted in a lot of what we were talking about. You know, you've got really big parental challenges and topics, yet kind of how to chip away at that connection and that repair with 15 minutes of play. So I think it's just such a fantastic resource, and I loved it, and I'm so happy that you created it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. I always ask the same question at the end of every episode, which is, if you could give just one gift to all the mothers in the world, what would that one gift be and why?
That one gift would be, you're good enough. And I think it's because I think in our social media world, the pursuit of perfection is going to cripple all of us. And actually, if I could just say, you're good enough, and you're going to get it wrong, and you're going to get it mostly right. And getting it mostly right most of the time is good enough. You're good enough.
Beautiful. I'm going to take that into my day. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. I've enjoyed talking with you.
So that was the episode. I hope that you really enjoyed it. As ever, if you did, please consider sharing it with your friends and leaving me a review on iTunes. It really does make a difference to the number of mums that we can reach with the brilliant wisdom of the guests I have on. Also, just a reminder about the Family Reset Plan. It's my latest offering to parents. I think that we are living in probably the challenge of our lifetimes. Well, definitely so far. And as parents, we not only have to support ourselves, we also have to support our children. And that is a lot. So the Family Reset Plan is myself and two brilliant psychologists. And we give you step-by-step, simple, applicable ways that you can support yourself emotionally to feel stronger, calmer, and therefore to support your children in a different way. It's all grounded in psychology and neuroscience. It's just £25 currently. And if you work for the NHS, it is totally free for you. So check out the website, familyresetplan.co.uk. Take care. I'll see you next time.